So it's a pleasure for me to start the next session about improving prosthetics. And the first speaker will be Professor Zrenner from Tübingen. So I think everybody knows Professor Zrenner. He has really established a huge vision center in Tübingen. So now Tübingen is really on the map of vision research at the international level. And he has also developed the retinal prosthesis on the subretinal, I mean, in the subretinal field. And so it's a great pleasure to have Professor Zrenner presenting all the clinical data about the retinal implants. Please, Professor.
So good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank José Sahel that he has organized this meeting in collaboration with the Leopoldina. Leopoldina is the National Academy of Sciences in Germany, and as you have seen in the program, there are five members marked, and it's wonderful to have this collaboration across borders among academies. And the Leopoldina was founded in 1652, and is one of the few institutions in Germany who have survived any political system without interruption, although it was very difficult for various reasons in various points of time. And it's an academy that looks forward, as you can see in the most recent statement for the G7 members, nurturing future scientists. So the present-day society heavily relies upon science-based discovery, technology, and policies. And that's what we are speaking about, and the topic is future. Improving prosthetics is a question, but I will start first with explaining you the concept of a subretinal implant, and then report about a study in 29 patients with a previous version of the implant, and then many of you have ophthalmologists that know already, but then I will tell about our new implant, which has a much longer survival time than the one we had in the study. And finally, I will report about future short-term and long-term goals as it was discussed with the Lasker Initiative. Okay, so we got a lot of support from Federal Ministry of Research from 1995 on when we started this project until 2007. But universities are not there to produce devices, so Retina Implant was founded, and we have received support from Retina Implant AG as recipients of grants and inventors and so on. Okay, so there are three different principles how to address neurons of the retina. So one is the epiretinal approach. There is an American system from Second Sight, the Argus II, which has received permit to be distributed in the United States and Europe. And they go on the epiretinal side. So everything has to be processed outside the body and then is hooked up right to the ganglion cells and their axons to be sent to the brain, though no processing is used of the remaining retina. Subretinal implant, the one I present now, it's different. It goes, so to say, under the retina, beneath the retina, uses in part this processing power of the remaining neurons. Also this allows, because wires is still a problem, as Marconi said 100 years ago, if it doesn't work, it's always the wire. And we had wire problems, which we solved. So there are 60 electrodes with epiretinal implant Argus II, there are 1,600 in the subretinal implant, because each pixel can be autonomous. And then there is a subchoroidal approach done in Japan and also in Australia, where the implant with the electrode sits behind the choroid, so there is a larger distance to the receiving neurons of the retina, in this case the bipolar cells, because the disease, retinitis pigmentosa, destroys the light-sensitive neurons, but leaves intact for many years bipolar cells, amacrine cells, and ganglion cells. So suprachoroidal is on the other side of the choroid, but also addresses mainly bipolar cells or dormant photoreceptor cells. So if we magnify that, you see the subretinal implant here just at the region where the degenerated photoreceptors had been in the blind people, people blind from hereditary retinal diseases that destroy photoreceptors. So instead of a natural photoreceptor, there is a technical one, a photodiode that takes a light, and then there's an amplifier, because the light alone on this very tiny piece of a few micrometers, square micrometer sized photodiode is not sufficient to excite the neuron, so it has to be amplified first, and then the amplified current, depending on the brightness of the light, it can be less or more current in terms of charge, is transmitted to the bipolar cells in the subretinal approach or to dormant photoreceptors. Of course, the amplifier needs supply of power, and so there is also a very thin cable under the retina going to retinal periphery, leaving the eyeball and going to a connecting piece behind the ear, which I will show in a moment. But let's first look through the pupil of a patient who has received such an implant, the so-called retina implant alpha IMS. That's the version we started with in 2005. So you see the optic nerve head here, hopefully, yeah, with the vessels crossing the implant, because the implant is beneath this transparent retina. So the light, like in normal photoreceptors, first goes through the transparent retina. So it opens a window, almost like a diamond. This is 15 degrees of visual field across corners. So we know that patient who have 50-degree visual field can handle very well to get around. It's not perfect, but it is sufficient. For reading, for instance, we need a field of 5 degrees, roughly. So 15 degrees is sufficient for mobility and finding objects. So if we ask, why did we choose this approach and not another one? Why not going epiretinal, like in the cochlear implant does, which goes at the output of the organ, we are going at the input of the eye. So we say, okay, number one, photodiodes and electrodes correspond to the correct localization in the visual field. Because if you have an electrode here, that may arise from a neuron which is up there. So stimulating a fiber here could produce a visual sensation which is way up, different from different localization from the electrode localization. Second, we thought, okay, remaining network can be used. So this is still not completely understood how the messages get to the brain. And so we use simply this beautiful neurocomputer. Fixation is easier. In the epiretinal side, it's not easy to put something onto the retina. So our second site, the company who produces Argus 2, they use a tack which goes through to the sclera and keeps the implant on the surface of the retina, on the inner surface of the retina. Eye movement helps localizing object. If you have a camera outside, you need a head movement. Inside, you can use the eye movement, and we are used to find things where we look at and not where we put our head to. And there are no visible parts outside except regular glasses. Everything is in the body except behind the ear, the connection piece for power. And also very important, we have microsaccades. We discussed that yesterday. Little eye movements all the time. If we suppress eye movements by any means, pictures disappear. A frog, anyhow, but in our eye, if we stabilize the image, pictures disappear. So this natural eye movement that the brain always knows where the eye looks at is a very important part for refreshing the image and avoid this fading. Okay, that were We are now in 1995, that were the ideas of 1995, and so we started. And of course we had to overcome a number of things. We had to test biocompatibility in pig, does the retina tolerate the implant? Biostability, does the implant tolerate the retina? Much more difficult. This is a hostile environment with all the ions, with water, and so on. And we didn't know anything in 1995 about electrical characteristics, so we used multi-electrode arrays to stimulate the retina. How much current do we need? How much current is too much? So we learned 1 nanocoulomb per electrode is enough in the size of electrodes, roughly 70 to 100 micrometer at that time. The distance of electrodes was important. Also 100 micron can be still resolved at the output of the retina if we stimulate with 2 electrodes in the outer retina. And where are the damage threshold? Yeah, once after 5 years we had to look into pig brain, does it really arrive if we stimulate epi or subretinal, done by Eckhorn and colleagues. We saw, yes, signals do arrive at the visual cortex that can be resolved with 1 degree of resolution, and 1 degree of resolution is my thumb. I have a little bigger thumb here, and in this visual distance. And we had to learn about to implant something under the retina. People said, okay, very difficult to go to the choroid. Yes, it is, but it turned out that it can be done without problems so far, major problems so far. Development of the implant, so we had then, after all these years, to build something. So 10 years later, we came up with this implant. I'll show you in a moment. And we calculated what possibly under ideal situations could be seen, and we never thought that such ideal situations can be achieved if we have 1,500 little pixels, each pixel having 3 to, in this case, I think 9 gray levels. What can be done? So this was just modeled with little dots with 9 different gray levels, and that's indeed in a few patients. We almost reached that goal, that what patient reported us. Yes, I can see somebody loving, I can see whether somebody has glasses or not, I can see the haircut and so on in some patient. So, having then, after 10 years, the idea how to do it, we built it, the Alpha IMS, after pilot study. So you see there is this piece behind the ear, that's a receiver antenna under the skin with a magnet in the center, and then there is a cable going to the eye and ending up in that little chip. Here it enters the eye, and here is this chip magnified now here, 3 times 3 millimeter, with the connection pieces, the lines for power, another line for controlling the amplification, that means brightness, and also the maximum output, the gain of an amplifier, all 1,500 amplifiers at once in this implant. And we had, of course, a return electrode where all the currents produced here come back in making the loop necessary for properly powering it. So the patient has a little transmitter antenna with another magnet, so he simply clips it on the back of the ear, so this, through this subdermal magnet it keeps in place, and then there is this tiny cable like an iPhone earplug, and then it ends in a little box with batteries and electronics where the patient has 2 knobs to adjust brightness and contrast, like in a very old TV system of the 50s, where you could adjust brightness and contrast. And that's what the patient reports. They see a little flickering light. The refreshing rate is usually between 5 and 7 hertz. So that's what what we had then available in 2005. Surgical procedure. There was a problem in the beginning, but now we have altogether a high number of patients, 50 patients, if you count them all so far, operated with this procedure. So you see there is a cut made here, a little window of the sclera, then a cut is made into the remaining part of the sclera after this tunnel procedure. Then there is a flexible guiding foil which builds a tunnel, so it's put under the retina. You will see it in a moment arriving here. It's blue, so easily to be seen. So it has marks exactly to know how deep to go. And then it protects the retina. And then between the RPE, retinal pigment epithelium, and this foil which protects the neurons, the implant is advanced through that tunnel. And behind the guiding foil, it will come slowly. You see it arriving here. So the chip is in place. It has a tip, a tongue, so the last millimeter is done by the chip alone. And then the guiding foil is retracted. And then there is a direct connection of the implants to the remaining dormant photoreceptors or bipolar cells. Okay, that's the principle. It takes a few hours because you have first to implant behind the ear and then have the cable going to the orbita. Then the orbita, the cable makes a loop so the eye can move freely. And then another team takes over, the ophthalmology team, and puts it into the eye just as I have shown it so far. So we started with a pilot study with 11 patients, and we were very careful, had the chip in the periphery initially because we thought, yeah, the periphery vision is good enough. But with the last three patients, we learned, published here, we learned that it has to get under the fovea to have proper vision, because this foveal pathway is the one we have learned seeing, we have learned to recognize images, learned reading, and so the input to the brain through the fovea is much larger. So it's a large portion of the visual cortex that deals just with the fovea. So that's a place really to go. So we had a number of colleagues in various countries where we did then, after we learned what you have to do in the pilot study, where we did a multi-center study published in Vision Research last year, and I will report about that now. There are all patients which have rod cone dystrophy. We had one cone rod dystrophy. Actually, there was one choroideremia patient as well. So we had 29 patients, different sites. They were 53 years old, and they were blind, and a period since last reading, we always ask when did you read last time newspaper, was roughly 17 plus minus 9 years. So a long time of blindness. Just to make that short, the surgical implant procedures were all successful. The chip arrived at the pole. We never had to stop a surgery or something like that. There was no retinal detachment during implantation. We had one at explantation, which was immediately corrected. We had no major hemorrhages except one again at a minor one at explantation and one at implantation without sequelae. So it was actually quite a good outcome because the blood is removed over time and we used RTPAs anyhow, and we had no major inflammation so far. Okay. What do we do with the patient? First thing is to expose him to the basic light and motion test. The patient looks at a screen, and we look at light detection, also temporal resolution, two or three flashes in a row, object localization, always in four alternative force choice. Is the flashlight going up or left or right? And it all is controlled with chip power on and chip power off. Grating is very helpful because we can make fine gratings or coarse gratings in different directions. The patient has to say which direction the grating is arranged. And if it's fine, then you cannot see. So we can use the threshold for grating vision. And the Landolt ring, which is the only really ophthalmological test, accepted test, where the patient looks for a gap and indicates where the gap is looking at, top, left, right, bottom. Okay, so, but before we do this test, the patient has to learn again the hand-eye coordination. Patient may have lost in the brain exactly where in the visual system is an object which I touch. So if he looks at first time, he may always be not in the middle, but next to it. So we just give him a little dot or also a quadrant, depending, and the patient has to say where it is. And then the same is done without power on, and that is then the control. So hand-eye coordination is number one. Then we look for the basic functions. You see the setup here. There's a beamer and a screen, so we can change luminance and contrast of the stimulus. And to summarize, of the 29 patients, 25 had light perception. There were four that had no perception. In three cases, it was either the optic nerve or the retina or a vascular system. The vascular system is, of course, important for the inner retina. We have very few where it doesn't work, but every once and then the vascular system in the central retina is very degenerated. And we had one technical problem where one line was not functioning after surgery. Then visual resolution, light source localization, 17 of the 29 did well, grating acuity, that is the test I just explained, up to 0.3 cycles per degree, so this is 1 degree my sum, so if I do three lines on my fingernail, that would be three cycles per degree, so 0.3 cycles per degree is the same in this distance, so like three sums, I don't have a third one, sorry. Okay. Now, Landolt rings, only four could do that, but up to a very high, relatively not very, it's all ultra low vision, but we were very pleased that we had four patients that could see in the range of 20 over 500. And that, what does that mean? That means that in the gap of the Landolt ring in eight directions, there is 1.8, so roughly 2 pixel in this gap. There need to be 1 to 2 pixel in this gap to really see the gap. So, of course, the eye is moving permanently, so it may be different region where this gap is finally recognized. So that comes close to the resolution because the light never would be a square distribution. It's always a type of a scatter in that where you have a Gaussian light distribution and you need kind of see the maximum of the contrast. Then grayscales, different grayscales, some had only very few, but some in the previous study had also 9, but usually they have 3 to 6. The clock task worked in 5, really see the small and the large error, and letters, really reading words, short words like ADAC or Vapiano, even a long word. So patient come back and report, I found my master on myself today. Vapiano I could see, especially light letters on dark background work very well. So that's the first test we do, and then we have the activities of daily living. Activities of daily living, we present either little geometric figures or tableware around a fixed plate, so that could be the other four objects could be anywhere around here, and they ask how many do you see, where are they, by pointing and name them. Of course, naming is difficult because it's not so easy to get a fork from a knife differentiated. And then a mobility trainer scales it, see nothing or seen it all correct, how many they are, where they are, and what they are. So they get a score 4. So you see an example here. So knife and fork was difficult, but the other ones were good. But of course, I can use the haptic abilities. So if we look at the outcome published just last year, we see the blue bars if the light is if the power is switched on. How does the patient rate in performance? 0 worst, 4 best, so 2.5 to 3. If the power is off, that are the red bars, very little, randomly correct, is seen. And you see always on the left column the shapes, on the right column the table tasks for month 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, 12. And you see they always do better with chip on, but there are two things. First, we lose a number of patients over the 12 months, so we have only 8 left. So the survival time of the device was not good enough for really distributing it to a larger community. And second, also interesting, some improve over time. And that's not surprising because you may know that electric stimulation in rats, very well established since 2001 in many papers, is releasing endogenous growth factors, CNTF, BDNF, and so on. So electrical stimulation, also reported by Chow and others, Pardew, shows that it can help for releasing such growth factors and probably, at least in some patients, improve vision, let's say, have longer outer segments or reactivate dormant photoreceptor cells. So if we look then, before I go deeper into the question of survival time of devices, what do patients see? Just a few points, shape of another person's head, mouth, glasses, baby in white dress. They go home, they use the instrument, and they report and come back. I have seen the town hall today or street lamps at night where I had the feeling that it goes in a certain direction. Car lights moving or also dog tail walking, garden table, moon, such things, own body, of course, or fluorescent tube, kitchen object, and so on. So they go out and discover. One example, that's in Tübingen restaurant. You see she has this connecting piece behind the ear. So she finds it and she also finds the cutlery, I abbreviate that a little bit. And also our colleagues in Oxford, they had nice experiences with their patients. The sound is on, but somehow the movie didn't get in. So the lady tells, I see something round and a building on the left and a building on the right. And if one sketches what she has told, and that's what Robert McLaren did, that's in various portions what she may have seen. So contrasts, which we are not using so much, shadows, so to say, produce contrasts that help the patient enormously to sketch in the brain, so to say, the scene. Another example. Oxford. I like that because the dog has suddenly nothing to do anymore, is offended. So she can walk along the street. So the outcome as a whole, after the study, after 3 years, we knew, okay, roughly a quarter has no real benefit because of several reasons. Some are not motivated enough. It's like skiing. You have to learn a bit of reading. You have to train yourself. You have to be interested in how it works. Then, but four of them, which I showed you a moment ago, it didn't work, but for others, they didn't have benefit. Roughly half have useful experiences in daily life, so they use it. Others can localize light sources, so the implant works, but the benefit is limited, either because frequency may be not 7 hertz, but 2 hertz, so it doesn't get faster, so several points. So conclusion one is, artificial vision is best transmitted through foveal pathway in the central field, We can use a magnification factor. The fading can be avoided by microsaccades. Visual acuity can be get up 2540. The number and shape of unknown objects can be identified, so patients can see letters in reading distance of 4 to 8 centimeters in height. And activities of daily living are very much improved after learning period. Not in all patients, but the majority of patients have benefit more or less. But there was this problem, survival of implant alpha IMS was less than 1 year, so what to do? You can restore, and then after a year or so, sometimes works longer, we have a problem. The problem turned out to be corrosion. The implant was not watertight enough, so we had to improve that. And since 2011, we are working very hard to find the right materials, and now the alpha AMS has been tested in 14 patients altogether. You see, it's not much different. It has a little shorter reference electrode. The implant's foil is a little bit broader here, but there's a slightly different electronics in there with more possibilities. And if you look at both chips, they don't look very much different. That's the IMS and that's the new AMS chip. You see some electronic here. You see the border is broader, so it's better protected against water on the borders, which was a weak, the soft point, so to say, than before. It's a little larger. It has 1600 and not 1500 electrodes, and the lines have been also changed. Quite interesting experiences we had, because it was helpful to get the chips back after they didn't work, and explanting and investigating where is the error. So it was very important to have a clinical study where you get the implant out and can investigate what's going on there. So if we compare now the cumulative survival rate, that is the IMS, the study I showed you. So roughly after 24 months, there was very few left from the beginning on. Now the new one, the AMS, is also 24 months. So 90% are still working without malfunction. There was one case where it was damaged during surgery, so that's not in there because that's not the survival thing. So they do survive, they are better, and that was reported at ARVO this year from our Oxford partners. You see the same tasks, again, on works very well, with off control is clear, for light, no light. That's difficult for them because many patients have phosphane, spontaneous flashes. So they have sometimes difficulties to discern their spontaneous flashes from the one produced by the chip. But direction of light, grating acuity works very well with the new implant as well. And 14 patients have been implanted so far. And after 4 years, actually 5 years of work, the implant got now the CE mark in February 2016 and can be distributed by Retina Implant AG now. Okay, where is the future? That was the main topic, and there is this beautiful meeting we had, several meetings at Janilia Farm finally, of the Lasker Foundation, which John Dowling told us in the very beginning of this meeting, and there's one chapter, Restoring Vision to the Blind, the New Age of Implanted Prosthesis. And there was a consensus, we met several times for several days, yes, visual prosthesis can provide useful vision in daily life. They are accepted by the patients. They have, of course, a lot of costs, but the evaluation of cost-benefit trade-off needs to be further investigated. Expectation of patients should be carefully managed. That's very important. You saw it doesn't work in each patient. So a patient has to be aware he may be one of those where either the vasculature system or the degeneration may be so much advanced, or the vascular system may be lost to such a degree that after implantation it wouldn't work. Primary outcome should not only look for visual acuity, but for improvement of independence and social connectedness. That's what actually the primary endpoint was, improve mobility and localization of object ability. And better image pre-processing will improve prosthetic vision. So we are looking for glasses that may do what we saw yesterday, these beautiful talks like filtering the image and give just several shapes instead of giving all the gray areas. So there are many possibilities. There was also consensus that the phosphine reliability has to be improved. And it was said that especially the epiretinal approach has a difficulty because it's always quite difficult to get this implant close to the retina so that each electrode has the same distance or can indeed activate neurons. On the epiretinal side, it's more difficult than in the subretinal side where it sits like a peanut in the vacuum package and really tightly touches the bipolar cells. Subretinal approach has another problem. There is a neural network which can fade at high frequency pulse strain, so it's a depolarization, but improved spatial resolution, it can be improved, and also the size of field can be improved. In our case, we easily could put two chips in there because they're autonomous. We didn't do that so far, that's possible. Improved contrast, we may build in circuits like the visual field, like the receptive field in neurons is doing, so that the lateral photodiodes and amplifiers inhibit the central one to increase contrast. Pre-processing shall be improved and standardized assessment of performance. So there's some activity going on to allow comparison among different implants. So the long-term research goals at the Alaska consensus meeting. How can we improve visual resolution and field size? Investigate the critical period in young children, like in the hearing area. But of course, these devices, it's important that our patients had visual ability, they had learned seeing in the brain, they shouldn't have amblyopia, otherwise it would be difficult for them to do 3D image from perception from a 2D image. How and when can we go beyond retinitis pigmentosa patients? And when will there be a cortical implant? And is it so that this permanent electrical stimulation of such implants does slow down degeneration, as we have seen in several studies? So these are the questions raised, and there is another approach not discussed yet, what I call the hybrid approach, that may be, why not having instead of electrical current as an output, it's my last slide, electrical current as an output, why not have light as an output, and have the bipolar cell with optogenetics make light sensitive, so you have a diode right at the bipolar cell, and you need only few photons to do it, so that would be light sensitive bipolar cells in combination with a subretinal implant instead of metal electrodes with current that dissipates everywhere to have the light on a small spot concentrated. Okay, so we have two different commercial systems, Argus II and retina implant Alpha IMS. They are suited for patients with hereditary degeneration. Visual acuity is not really high, and in lay language we would say around maximum 4%, but it helps the patient, the majority of patients. So still there's room for improvement, and that is under development at many centers. Finally, I would like to say that we have a great team sticking together for almost 20 years, and that we have great collaborators in Tübingen, Oxford, Dresden, Singapore, Budapest, London, and Hong Kong, and I thank you for your attention.